speaking with Stephen Cave, author of Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. Stephen, the subtitle of your book is The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization, which is quite a provocative statement. Do you really think our obsession with immortality has shaped civilization?
Yes, I do. And all living things want to keep going, to project themselves into the future. And we humans are no different. And in fact, because we have these massive brains, we can conceive of the future extending indefinitely before us. So whereas other creatures just want to survive moment by moment, we want to live forever. And civilization is how we try to do that.
You'll have to explain that. How do we do that through civilization?
Well, think, for example, of all the material aspects of civilization. So we build buildings to give us shelter, and we have clothing to keep us warm. Agriculture puts food on the table. Medicine prevents us from falling to disease. So all of these material aspects of civilization, they really exist just to help us live longer. But of course, even though they really do help us to live longer, still death looms over us. And so we have these other aspects of civilization, these more symbolic cultural religious aspects like art and Christianity, that promise that even if the buildings and the agriculture and the medicine don't do it for us, still we can live on.
Now, I'm curious, would you consider yourself death-obsessed in some way? I mean, is death kind of always in the back of your mind?
I think all of us are struggling with the fact of death. Now, some people deny it better than others. Some people have stories that are so satisfying about how we're not really going to die, about how we can live forever, that death is not present in their mind. But of course, if you start to doubt those stories, then suddenly death appears in your life. And that can happen through a crisis of faith or through a loved one dying, for example. And suddenly you have to face up to your mortality somehow. And of course, this is what I've been writing about in my book. And so for me, the book has been a process, a journey of facing up to these fears.
So in some ways, it is a personal exploration for you.
Yes, absolutely. I wanted answers to these questions about how long we've got. Is it 60 or 70 years or 150 or eternity? And I think I also had something of a crisis of faith as a young man, and wasn't satisfied with the stories that the grown-ups around me were telling me when I was a child. And so I wanted to find out for myself. And the answer I got to at the end surprised me. It wasn't where I expected to end up when I set out on the project.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure we will get there. And you approach this subject in many different fascinating ways. For instance, you talk about something you call the mortality paradox. Can you explain what this is?
Right. Well, the mortality paradox, it starts with the realization that at some point, some early human's brain got big enough for them to realize, oh my God, we're going to die. I mean, presumably mice and snakes, they don't know this. They live from moment to moment. But because we can conceive of ourselves in the future, we can have this realization. All living things die. I'm a living thing. I'm going to die. And this is, of course, terrifying. And this forms one side of the mortality paradox. But on the other hand, we can't really imagine not existing. We can't conceive of dying, of being dead. It's a kind of logical impossibility. So this is the paradox. On the one hand, death seems to us inevitable and inescapable. On the other hand, it seems inconceivable and impossible. And this is a contradiction. But we don't live with this contradiction. We don't live with this paradox. We tell ourselves stories that help to resolve it.
Isn't this something Sigmund Freud figured out a long time ago, that we could never imagine, we could never conceive of our own non-existence? It's just sort of, it's impossible to wrap our head around that idea.
That's exactly right. This is something Sigmund Freud was writing in 1915. He talked about how we can't imagine not existing because we are always there as the observer. If you imagine your own funeral, you're still a perceiving eye looking down on it. You're still there in some sense. And so he said, in our unconscious, none of us really believe that we're going to die. We're all convinced of our own immortality. And he wrote that just sitting in his armchair thinking about it. But since then, in the centuries since then, there have been empirical studies done by psychologists that show that this is true, that cognitively we are not capable of conceiving of dying, and therefore we're all predisposed to believe in our immortality.
Or we somehow know we are going to die, but we can't actually put our minds into the possibility that we are actually dead or that we wouldn't exist at all.
That's right. This is the paradox. We We see that we're going to die, because all people do, all living things do, and yet we can't really accept that because it's so inconceivable to us. This is the paradox.
Which suggests that it would scare a lot of people. I mean, you know, basically we know we're going to die. We can't do anything about it. We're incapable of in some deep way of dealing with the terror of death. But there are strategies. And you, for instance, talk about something called the terror management theory. What is that?
That's right. The terror management theory is this body of research in psychology that says, look, the basic fact that we're going to die is terrifying to us. We're not built to have to deal with this fact. And so we tell ourselves stories. We shape our worldview in ways that help us to manage the terror of death. That's why it's called terror management theory. Now, various thinkers and philosophers and people like Freud have fought this in the past, going back thousands of years. But the people, the researchers behind terror management theory, a group of American psychologists, set out to actually prove this in the lab. So, for example, they'd take a group of people. One recent study took a group of agnostics, that is, people who are kind of undecided in their religious views, and they reminded half of them they were going to die, and the other half they made to think about dental pain or something equally horrible, but not death. And then they asked them again about their religious views. Now, those who had been reminded of their mortality were afterwards twice as likely to express faith in God, even though beforehand they were all equally agnostic. So remind people of death, get them to think about mortality, and they run to Jesus. So this is evidence that our religions, for example, are strategies we have to help us deal with the fear of death. And this applies not just to religion, but the terror management theory researchers have now, in over 400 studies, shown this applies also to nationalism. So the idea that you can live on as part of your nation, or the desire for fame, for example, or even the desire to have children.
Well, let's talk about this in more detail, because you have argued that there are four basic ways that every civilization chases after immortality. Basically, we have four immortality narratives. The first one you call staying alive. What is that?
Well, that's right. I think there appears at first to be a huge diversity of different kinds of story about how we can defeat death. But actually, they all fit into four basic categories. And the first of these, the first immortality story, is, as you say, staying alive. Because it's the most obvious. If you don't want to die, well, just keep going. Just stay alive. So it's the idea that we can do that in this body, on this earth, forever. And we mentioned before that civilization is helping us to do this. I mean, life expectancy has doubled in the last couple hundred years, from just 40 to 80 in the Western world. So we're really making this happen. We really are living longer. And yet still the idea that we can stay alive forever just seems a little bit eccentric. And yet every culture in human history has some story of an elixir of life or fountain of youth or something that can help to keep us going forever.
And scientists have taken up this quest. I mean, there is this little core of scientists who are out there who are basically trying to engineer immortality. I mean, the idea is that if you could identify all the things that break in our bodies, you know, and the things that eventually kill us, we could, in theory, replace all those defective genes or, you know, crumbling body parts and conquer death.
That's right. It seems, well, once we accept the scientific worldview, life is just molecules, as the American chemist Linus Pauling said, who won two Nobel Prizes for his work in biochemistry. He genuinely believed that we could defeat aging, defeat disease, and so defeat death. Because if life is just molecules, I mean, if life is just cells and atoms, and this is what the scientific worldview teaches us, then we can fix all of these problems. If life is just molecules, well, we can manipulate molecules, we can control them. And so all of these problems that lead to death, cancer and heart disease, even terrible accidents, terrible traumas, well, ultimately, they're all fixable. And so we just need to keep pushing forward the boundaries of medicine until eventually we're all going to be living forever.
Well, and then there's a certain part of what's called the transhumanist movement that takes this even further and says, you know, we don't necessarily need biological parts. You know, we can replace the biological stuff that dies with machine parts. You know, we can become cyborgs and eventually download our brains. And, you know, who needs a body?
Exactly. Biology is unreliable. It's messy. It gets squashed and squished. Yeah. So instead, these kind of technological utopians aspire to replace all of our squishy, unreliable parts with, as you say, silicon or with computers. We can make backup copies of ourselves. So even if the worst happened and we're in a plane crash, then a new me can just roll out of the immortality factory. This is the kind of immortality story. These are ancient stories, really, but we're seeing them retold using the language of digital technology and stem cells and computers, etc. We're seeing these ancient stories retold in the language of our time.
Well, there are fascinating philosophical questions as here. I mean, suppose we really could have this digital brain, which is a huge hypothetical. I mean, no one knows whether we could really do that, but would that digital brain still be you?
Well, that's a very good question, and philosophers argue about this. I think it wouldn't. Now, and you can look at it like this. Imagine that you have backed yourself up. So you've had a complete brain and body scan, you're sort of uploaded yourself, and you're so that if the worst happened, then a new you can just roll out of the immortality factory. Now, imagine you're in a plane crash, and so the signal gets sent to the immortality factory, quick, make a new Steve. But it turns out that you survive the crash, but the factory doesn't know that, and a new Steve comes out. Well, suddenly there are two of you. But your relationship to the new Steve is just the same as it would be if you died. That is, it's just been made on the basis of this information. But if you went and passed it in the street, or you go back to your wife and children and find that this other Steve is there and sitting at the table, and you know, you get into a fight, I mean, you know that's not you. That's not really you. It's just a copy. And so the worry with all these kind of strategies, the idea that you can upload yourself or copy yourself or live on as an avatar, is that actually what we're doing is not living on, but just making copies of ourselves, just like a sophisticated photo of ourselves.
One thing that's striking about this whole discussion is that a lot of these questions go way back, including into say, ancient Greek mythology. I mean, for instance, you write about something called the Tithonus problem?
That's right. I think the Greeks were aware of, or they thought about immortality and mortality a lot. And they had a lot of stories that summed up these kind of contradictions and tensions. Now, one of these stories is that of Tithonus. And Tithonus was this beautiful boy. And he was so beautiful that the goddess of the dawn fell in love with him. And so she went to Zeus and asked Zeus to make this boy immortal so that they could be together forever, because she was a goddess, so she was already immortal. Well, Zeus did this, but she didn't ask Zeus to grant him eternal youth. So Tithonus lived forever, but he still got older and more wizened and more decrepit until eventually he disappeared into a little cricket whining in the corner, pleading for death. And the risk that what we're doing with our technology is that we're helping people to live longer, but without stopping aging, without giving them that quality of life. So people aren't so much living longer as just dying slower. And the real challenge then for our biomedical establishment is not just to keep pushing forward that number of life expectancy, getting people to live longer, but instead to focus on quality of life for the years that we have.
Now, you have another immortality narrative, which you call resurrection, which has played an especially prominent role in certain religions like Christianity and Islam. Is this strictly a religious idea?
Well, the idea of resurrection, I think, is a very natural one. Now, it's not perhaps as obvious as just staying alive, but we see around us that all those people who have claimed to have found elixirs of life in the past, the one thing they now have in common is they're all 6 foot under. So we need a backup plan. And we see that backup plan in nature. In winter, the plants die back, but in spring, they burst into life. And many cultures have festivals that celebrate this kind of rebirth. And so it's not mad for humans to think, well, maybe we can take part in that. Maybe, okay, we have to die, but maybe we too can rise up and live again. And this is the resurrection idea. And so we see it in many different forms in many cultures.
And there's a scientific component to this as well. I mean, the whole idea of cryogenics, freezing the body with the idea that some future medical technology will be able to bring people back to life.
That's right. Just as many people believe that an omnipotent God will one day raise them up to live again. Just as a lot of people believe that an omnipotent God will raise them up to live again, some people believe an omnipotent scientist will do it instead. They think that when we die, we can have ourselves frozen. And then in the future, when science and technology is advanced enough, we can be thawed out and repaired and so live again.
And yet there would seem to be a basic problem with this idea. Not only do you thaw the frozen corpse. You got to bring them back to life. I mean, they've died, and you know, we don't know how to sort of go from death and back to life.
That's right. We don't. We don't know if we were able to put a person back together, whether it really would be the same person, or if, again, we haven't just made a copy of that person. And this is something that the early Christians struggled with. When Rome was repressing and persecuting the Christians, they would kill a Christian and then let them rot and then burn what remained and then scatter those ashes in the river and then say, ha, okay, resurrect that. And so early theologians had to deal with this problem. They said, well, okay, God could take all of the different atoms and put them back together, and then that would make it the same person. And then some theologian would say, aha, but what about those Christians who were eaten by wild animals in the circus, which was something that happened in ancient Rome, and then another Christian accidentally eats part of those wild animal, and then so a person has become part of another person, and so there aren't enough pieces for God to put together. And so we run into all these kind of paradoxes and ultimately say, okay, well, God's just going to make this person out of whatever bits he wants. But then again, what makes it the real person, the same person, and not just a copy?
Right. Well, then there's another solution to this, which is your third immortality narrative, and that's the soul. Okay, maybe we don't have to worry about, you know, the body living on forever, but the soul perhaps could once the body dies.
That's right. The idea of the soul neatly solves this problem for us. Now, and we see this in the history of Christianity. Early Christians put their faith in the resurrection. They thought they'd die, and then they're properly actually dead until the moment of resurrection. But we have this problem about putting people back together. And so some Christians thought, well, hang on, if we've got a soul as well, then the soul can bridge this gap. So we're not really dead, because this fundamental part of us, the soul, is living on. And this is a hugely attractive idea, because then suddenly we're not dependent upon this messy, unreliable body, but we each have a part of us, if you like, the real me, the real you, that is by its nature immortal, that can leave the body behind. And so death, then, instead of becoming a source of anxiety, becomes liberation. It's the moment when the soul is free. And if you have that view, then it's much easier to deal with the fear of mortality.
Of course, there are all kinds of philosophical problems with the soul. I mean, are we talking about our consciousness living on precisely as it was when we had a body and a brain and all of that? Or, I mean, does the sense of self stay together?
Well, in the West, when most people think of a soul, they think of their full personality, their consciousness and their memories and their desires and their beliefs. But the problem is, science suggests that all of those things, consciousness and memories, are dependent upon the brain. And of course, if I knock you on the head in a certain way, or that is, if a bit of your brain is destroyed, then your memories can disappear, or other fundamental parts of you can disappear if your brain is damaged, your capacity for love or your idea of right and wrong. And the question is, well, if these things are actually dependent upon a soul, how is it that they get knocked out when a bit of the brain's damaged? And if your memories or your capacity for right and wrong can't survive just a bit of your brain being damaged, what makes us think it can survive when your whole brain dies, like when you die? And so increasingly people are becoming skeptical of the idea that the real me or the real you can actually just leave the body behind.
What about the idea of reincarnation? Where does this fit into these schemes?
Well, reincarnation is a soul story. It says that the real me, the real you, is actually a soul that can move from body to body. As the Bhagavad Gita put it, which is one of the core texts of Hinduism, the soul leaves the body behind just like you or I cast off an old set of clothes. So it's a version of the soul story that says the soul goes from body to body. So the idea of reincarnation is absolutely dependent on the idea that the real me or you can leave the body behind. And of course, exactly that is what science is suggesting can't happen.
Right. You have a fourth immortality narrative, which you call legacy. How there are various strategies that we have to leave a lasting legacy, even if we ourselves don't survive.
Well, that's right. Some people think, well, okay, maybe the real me or isn't a physical thing or a soul, but more like I'm more like a bundle of different elements. And when I die, these elements might dissipate, but they can live on. So I can have children, for example, or I might live on in the memories of other people or in the work I've done. And this is a hugely influential view in our culture. I mean, if we take, for example, the iconic figure of Achilles, the great Greek hero, He stood on the beaches of Troy deciding whether to fight. And he knew that if he stayed and fought, then he would die. And he knew that because it had been prophesied by his mum, who was a goddess. He would die but become the most famous warrior ever. Or he could go home and live a long and happy life as the kingdom of as the king of a minor kingdom. And he chose to stay and to give his life in order to win immortal fame. And of course, many hundreds of thousands of people in Western civilization have copied exactly that model since.
But there's also a dark side to this as well. I mean, there are people who, it would seem, do horrible things just so they will be remembered. I mean, they'll be remembered for their infamy, for this atrocity that they've committed.
That's right. And I mean, it's the same now as it was in Achilles' time. We have these idea of these heroes who live forever, and we all want to be like that. And as kids, that's what we aspire to. Those are our role models. But at some point when growing up, most of us realize we don't have the strength or the skills to be great heroes. Now, most of us live with that. But some people instead choose to be villains. So if they can't become famous for their great deeds, they'll instead choose infamy. Now, there was this one figure, Herostratus, and there's a Herostratus syndrome named after him, of pursuing fame through infamous deeds. And this Herostratus, on the night that Alexander the Great was born in 356 BC, this guy who was completely unknown, he burnt down the temple in Ephesus. And this temple was one of the seven wonders of the world. It had taken 120 years to build. It was massive, glorious, spectacular. People came from all around the world to see it, and he completely destroyed it. And when asked why, he said, to become famous. And of course, he was tortured and he was killed, and mention of his name was banned on pain of death. And yet, here we are, over 2,000 years later, still talking about him.
Well, it makes me think of those young kids who go into schools and shoot them up, you know, often with the idea that they themselves will die. And you have to wonder if they're doing that just to become celebrities in this ghoulish way.
Exactly. It's the flip side of celebrity culture. For those who can't win thousands and millions of fans through great singing, you know, for those who don't have the talent to become a great basketball player, what remains? Well, they can pick up a gun and shoot people and so get on the news.
Now, we've been talking with the assumption that everyone wants immortality in one way or another, but that is not absolutely obvious. That would be such a great thing. And there are people who have questioned it. For instance, the great Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges wrote a story called The Immortal. Can you describe what happens in that story?
Yes, Borges tells this wonderful story about a soldier in ancient Rome who he's seeking the river that cleanses men of death. And he goes on this great epic quest. And eventually he comes to this sort of desert. And there are these troglodyte-like people just lying around. One of them hasn't moved for so long that a bird has nested on his chest. And he finds out eventually these are the immortals. And he finds out one of them is Homer, who wrote the Odyssey and the Iliad. And this Roman soldier says, well, what a glorious thing. Aren't you proud? And Homer says, no, don't you see? If you live forever, it is impossible not to write the Odyssey, at least once. And so the idea is if we live forever, we'll all end up doing everything. And so we all become the same person, and we all become both villain and victim and king and pauper. And after a while, all meaning breaks down, all purpose breaks down.
I mean, that is a profound idea, that somehow we need mortality to have meaning in our lives.
That's right. It's mortality that gives us shape. It gives shape to our lives and forces us to make choices, and it's those choices that define us. If we have infinite time, we can all do everything. And so all our actions lose their meaning.
Okay, well, you have looked at all these immortality narratives that have been floating around for eons. You suggest that maybe there's another one, that we could have a better one, what you call the wisdom narrative. Explain what that is.
So I found, looking at all these immortality stories in different cultures, different times, there have always been these quiet voices that say, well, hang on, I'm not sure I'm convinced about this immortality story. And we find these voices in ancient Egypt, for example, you know, which dedicated its entire economy to the pyramids and the tombs and to mummification. Every now and again, we find a little bit of graffiti on a pyramid saying, now, hang on, all of these mummies, has anyone ever seen them come back? You know, make merry while you can. And this message we see in this recurring literature called the wisdom literature from the Near East. And that's why I call this story the wisdom narrative. I've taken that from these, from this wisdom literature, which we find, for example, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the oldest stories that we have, and in the wisdom books of the Bible, like the Psalms and Ecclesiastes, for example. And the message is always, well, look, we don't really know about this living forever business, and maybe it's not such a good idea. So let's focus on the here and now instead. Let's appreciate what we have. And that's very much the message of Ecclesiastes. And Psalm number 90 goes even further and says, learn to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. So actually learn to think about the fact that our time is limited. We have to face up to mortality in order to gain wisdom, which means in order to really appreciate the time that we have.
So what would that take to appreciate the time that we have, to appreciate that here and now in a more profound way?
Well, it means recognizing that every moment that we have is like a great stroke of luck, is a great gift. Instead of worrying about death that might come at some point in the future, appreciating the fact that we're alive now. And it's much easier to do that if you are conscious of mortality. And there really are traditions of in different cultures of people that actively remind themselves of death in a way that is not at all morbid, but is actually to increase their passion and appreciation of life. We see it in Buddhism, for example, people meditating on death in order to appreciate each day. We see it in the Middle Ages in Europe, people having a memento mori, a reminder that they're going to die, like a skull on their desk, for example, in order to remind them, look, every day is special. If you have forever, if you've got all the time in the world, you've got all the time to waste in the world. But we have no time to waste.
So I want to come back to you again. Have you figured out ways to do this, to, I don't know, bring the awareness of death into your own life so that you appreciate daily living more?
Well, looking through all these different ancient traditions, I think there were three themes that struck me, three virtues, if you like, that we can cultivate to help us to appreciate the time we've got and to manage this fear of death. And without slipping into denial, without telling ourselves these stories that I don't think are true. And these three virtues, the first one is to focus on the present, which we've talked about a bit already. So, I mean, death is something that can only happen in the future, but we never, you know, we're always actually in the present. And when death comes, we're not going to be around to realize that in a way. Death is the end of experience. It's like a horizon beyond which we can't look. So for as long as we're focusing on the present, we have what one theologian called the eternal now. We can only ever know what it's like to be alive. And so, and there are lots of traditions which help us to focus on the present, such as mindfulness meditation from Buddhism, for example, but the ancient Greek Stoics also practiced rituals to help them focus on the present. The second virtue that I think can help us to deal with the fear of death is gratitude. So, if you like, the fear of death is worrying that something that's special to us is going to be taken away. Is this fear we're going to lose something? Well, let's look at the flip side. Let's instead appreciate that we've got it at all. Just the very fact that you exist is a series of enormous coincidences. It's all the people, all your ancestors who had to survive and find each other, down to your parents who had to meet, the series of coincidences that have allowed you to live are so enormous that you have every reason to count yourself very lucky. So focus on being grateful instead, and it's a much more, you will be able to enjoy life much more than worrying about what you have being taken. And the third virtue that I think can help us to live more positively is focusing less on ourselves and identifying more with others. Now, if you think about it, death is the end of yourself. And we live in a society that really focuses all value on you and yourself, self-fulfillment, self-actualization, discovering yourself. Well, if you put yourself as the focus of all value, then death, the end of yourself, seems like the end of everything, the end of the world, a complete apocalypse. But if you focus instead on other people and other causes, then your own death seems much less important. And this is something that Bertrand Russell, for example, realized. He lived to be 97 years old, and he wrote this wonderful essay on aging in which he said, you know, the fear of death is not a very noble thing. And actually, if we break down the walls of the ego and focus more on others and these great causes and the great flow of life, then we find it much easier to come to terms with the fear of death and to live positively.
Well, that is a wonderful place to leave it. You've actually given us some solace in facing death here. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks. That was terrific.
Excellent. Good.
Good. Well, thank you. And our listeners will love this.
Oh, good. I hope so. When's it going out? Next week?
Yes, it is. At the end of next week.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much again.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
A lot of fun.
Okay, hope you have a good day. Okay,
and you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.